Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, a look at the Compromise of 1850 and the collapse of the second party system, with Gillis Harp, a professor at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. The class is part of a survey course called History of the United States to 1865, which covers American history from the colonial era through the Civil War. This is about 50 minutes.
All right, we'll begin, as usual, with a short selection from the Psalms. This is from Psalm 119. Blessed are they whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. Blessed are they who keep his statutes and seek him with all their heart. They do nothing wrong. They walk in his ways. You have laid down precepts that are to be fully obeyed. Oh, that my ways were steadfast in obeying your decrees. That's from Psalm 119. Okay, well, last time we left off talking about the election of 1848, and we said, remember, you may recall that the Whigs had taken a page out of the playbook of the Democratic Party in nominating a war hero. Rather ironic, since they nominated a war hero from a war that they had opposed pretty vociferously, and this was General Zachary Taylor. And we've got a poster there from the 1848 campaign with Taylor and the immortal Millard Fillmore. We'll talk more about him later. So Taylor manages, the Whigs under Taylor manage to defeat the Democratic Party candidate. The Democrats hurt very badly by internal divisions, especially within New York State, a really serious battle within New York State. Had New York gone a different direction, the Democratic nominee might have been elected instead of Zachary Taylor, the Whig nominee. But serious internal divisions within the Democratic Party in New York. I think I may have talked about this before. A lot of factionalism within the Democrats in New York. Factionalism, different elements, the so-called Hunker group and the so-called Barn Burner group. We won't get into that. But suffice to say, the Whigs again end up with a successful candidate, with electing a president in the form of Zachary Taylor, but ironically, again, someone who's not really a committed Whig, someone who is less than a diehard Whig, you know, in the Clay or Webster mold. Taylor had often portrayed himself not as a Whig candidate, but as a no-party candidate, as someone who's kind of above party, and he incorrectly assumed that a broad coalition had made him president, and that he owed little to the Whigs per se. Now, political historians know that's nonsense, that in fact it was the Whig Party machine that got him elected, but that was his perception. And the way that Zachary Taylor would attempt to deal with the Mexican cession, remember the Mexican cession, that's that territory ceded by Mexico to the United States as a result of the American victory in the war with Mexico. His approach to the Mexican cession would reflect this no-party approach, this no-party idea of his. The election, after all, had not really provided a solution to the problem of slavery in the territories, and no immediate solution was in sight. Now, remember, you've got a long gap here between Taylor being elected in November of 1848 and something actually happening in Washington. Well, first of all, long gap between him being elected in November of 48 and being sworn into office. In those days, it was in March. So not until March of 1849 do you have the end of the sort of lame duck period of his predecessor. Meanwhile, the gold rush in California was attracting thousands of new settlers west. Amid this policymaking vacuum, sectional animosities in Congress increased. So there's kind of a lack of leadership, there's a kind of power vacuum, and as a result, there's a lot of a pretty nasty debate in Congress, a lot of maneuvering, political maneuvering. Northern Democrats are flirting more and more with the Wilmot Proviso. Remember the proviso? We talked about that last time, the proposal to exclude slavery from any new territory acquired in the war with Mexico. Northern Democrats are flirting more and more with the proviso and also with something new, something called the Free Soil Party that had emerged. Some of them want to join that. Plus, Northern Whigs are alarmed at the initial moves of their newly elected president in forming his cabinet. Taylor skips over traditional Whigs such as Clay or Webster and ignores Clay's American system policy agenda. Taylor hoped to build some kind of new political movement, some sort of new party. Sometimes he called it the Republican Party, to be distinguished from the Republican Party that's later formed a couple years later here. Thus, most of Taylor's cabinets are actually enemies of what people called ultra-Whiggery. The way that Taylor doled out federal patronage also concerned old Whig regulars a lot. Remember, that's one of the key things presidents do. Well, a little bit less today, definitely true in the mid-19th century. That is, one of their most important jobs was to pay off people, to pay off supporters within the party. Complaints from party regulars poured into the White House as Taylor's first year in office went by. So you've got conflict between Taylor and his party. You've got a kind of power vacuum at the top. Oh, another aspect of the power vacuum is, as I said, Taylor's not inaugurated until March of 49. Congress doesn't actually go into session until December of 49. So again, you've got basically more than a year of not much happening. Okay, well, eventually, though, Taylor comes forward with a plan regarding the Mexican cession. What's his plan? You can see some of it eventually takes the form you see here. I'll explain how we get there. Taylor wanted California and other parts of the cession to bypass or skip the territorial stage and be admitted immediately as states. Thus, he thought, sidestepping the whole Wilmot Proviso question, right? I think it's a rather dishonest move in some ways, but think about it. You know, if you're talking about debating should we have slavery in the territories, Taylor's response is, okay, well, we won't have territories. No debate. We'll just bring these territories in immediately as states. By the time Taylor submitted the proposal to Congress, though, most Southern Whigs were annoyed with his cabinet and his patronage appointments that I mentioned already. They weren't interested in his proposal, which their Democratic opponents in the South called the Wilmot Proviso in substance, if not in form. So it was clear that Taylor's plan would garner little support in Congress. It seemed to be sort of dead on arrival. He didn't have sufficient support within the Whig Party. Democrats were certainly not inclined to support the proposals of at least nominally Whig president. Okay, so what happens? Who steps into the power vacuum? Predictably, it's Henry Clay, right? Clay, always an aspirant for the executive mansion, always someone interested in running for president. And Clay comes forward, the great compromiser. Remember, we talked about him in the context of the Missouri Compromise back in 1819, 1820. Clay comes forward with a package. His original set of 8 separate resolutions was introduced in late January of 1850. Again, note, quite a bit of time has passed. So January 1850. And actually, some of this first set of Clay's proposals looked something like Taylor's plan. Clay wanted to admit California immediately as a free state. It had recently, by the way, applied for admission with an anti-slavery constitution. The difference was that this measure was now tied, though at first rather loosely, to certain concessions to the South. Okay, so the beginnings of some kind of compromise are taking shape. And Clay saying, all right, well, we'll bring in California as a free state, but we recognize we have to grant some concessions to the South. As far as the other territories were concerned, well, the Wilmot Proviso was not necessary there because Clay believed nature would prohibit slavery from thriving in that part of the Southwest. You know, arid conditions, you're not going to have plantations there growing cotton. So why needlessly antagonize Southerners with the Wilmot Proviso, by excluding slavery in those territories? All right, so Clay, it seems, was trying to steal the administration's thunder and believed that if he could resolve the sectional debate, This would help him wrestle back control of the Whig Party. And he's definitely interested in running for president in 1852, although, as we'll see, he doesn't make it. He dies before then. But like Taylor, though, Clay had counted upon united Whig support in Congress, and it simply wasn't there by early 1850. Another senator by the name of Foote, Mississippi, name's not that important, tries then to combine these separate measures into a single omnibus bill. And let's pull this all together into one big package. That doesn't work either. He was hoping thereby to lock in Southerner concessions to Southerners for the admission of California as a free state. The battle over the bill's different parts, though, was very fierce. Eventually, the omnibus package had to be broken up into separate legislation and rammed through the Congress, interestingly, under the leadership not of a Whig, but of a Democrat, of a Northern Democrat, Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois. More about him later. But it's interesting that it's a Democrat that does it, not a Whig. Okay, so that's ultimately what gets passed. Here's the, here you can see what happens. Here's the package. You admit California as a free state. You these other territories, oh, you chop down the size of Texas, and you have these other territories, the question of slavery, the status of slavery in those territories to be determined by popular sovereignty. Makes sense because, after all, it's Douglas who's proposing this, and Douglas is a Democrat. Remember, Democrats had since 1840, well, since the late 1840s, had embraced this idea of popular sovereignty, or what's sometimes called squatter sovereignty. Okay, so what's the package then? Number one, California is admitted as a free state. Utah and New Mexico, as you can see on our map there, are organized as territories. Popular sovereignty there, as I said, to determine the status of slavery. Texas is compensated for loss of territory granted to New Mexico. That's number three. If you're not getting all these down, don't worry about it. Your text has them in some detail. Number three and number four, and perhaps most controversial, tough new federally enforced fugitive slave law is introduced. More about that in a minute. Also, the slave trade in Washington, D.C. is abolished. That is, the slave trade in D.C. is abolished, the selling of slaves in the nation's capital. Okay, so that's the package. And you can see, as I said, on the map here what that means. Ironically, these measures might not even have been made law had it not been for President Taylor's untimely death in July of 1850. Remember, we said that the Whigs had a bit of a hard luck story with electing presidents. They only elect two. Both of them die in office. Taylor dies in office in July of 1850, some indication that Taylor actually might have vetoed the compromise. But remember, Taylor is succeeded by my personal favorite, Millard Fillmore. I don't know why he's become such a brunt of jokes. Maybe it's just the name. I don't know. But Millard Fillmore is a diehard Whig. Taylor might not have been, but Fillmore is. Fillmore is a traditional Whig. He's busy fighting free soil forces within his own party, and consequently, Fillmore's eager to support the compromise, and he signs it into law. All right, so he's keen about getting the compromise through. In fact, as we'll see, Fillmore locks onto the compromise as a kind of test, as a litmus test for party loyalty in the Whig Party. And we'll see there's some dangerous consequences, some bad consequences that come from that. All right, well, let's step back for a minute here and analyze who supported the party and why. Excuse me, who supported the compromise and why. It's difficult to determine since the various measures were all voted upon separately and different voting alliances supported each measure. Thus, not unlike Clay's earlier Missouri Compromise, the Compromise of 1850, as we call it, is really more of an intersectional truce than it is a genuine compromise, you know, where everyone's sort of giving a little bit. It's really more of a timeout or a truce. Basically, though, one can generalize the attitudes regarding the compromise in this way. As you can see on our chart here, you can see that folks from the North, Whigs from the North tend to be anti-compromise. Democrats from the North, like Stephen Douglas, who champions it, he's the one whose parliamentary skills gets it through Congress, they tend to be pro-compromise. In the South, Whigs tend to be pro-compromise. Democrats, on the other hand, tend to be anti-compromise. Now, I want to pause for a second and analyze what's going on, because this is really important. Maybe I'll throw it open as a question. What's going on? How do you interpret this chart? What's happening to the second party system? I'm going to let you chew on that for a minute. What's happening to the second party system, and what does this chart tell us as far as what's happening to it? What's going on? Yes?
Do I need to go up there? Can I say
it? I think a man's going to come to you here. Go ahead.
The second party system is really splitting amongst itself. It's not really functioning as a second party system.
As a national
second party system. The Whig Party is actually splitting into almost two parties, and the Democrats are almost splitting into two parties. So the two party system's really collapsing in on itself on a national level.
Yes, exactly. We're really moving away from a well-integrated national party system. And so what this is evidence of is the beginnings of a sectional realignment. All right, as we move away from the second party system, or I should say as the second party system begins to collapse, you get the emergence of something new, still sort of taking form. We haven't seen exactly what form it's going to take yet, but you get a sectional realignment. In other words, it seems to be more important what part of the country you come from than what political party you're affiliated with. However, having said that, okay, that's a good point. But having said that, notice within the regions what's going on. So, for example, within the North, ignore the South for a minute. Within the North, what's going on in terms of the distinctive positions of the two parties? Remember, we talked a little bit about this last time in the 1848 election, and we said that it was kind of interesting how in those days the national parties could really run a candidate two different ways, could run him one way in the South and another rather different way in the North. Now, what's going on within the regions, within the sections, within the North, for example? What's happening? How are the parties trying to deal with this hot potato, political hot potato of slavery's expansion? Within the North, you've got what? What's happening? Anybody? Thoughts? Random ideas? Yes, Rick.
The Whigs are opposed to the expansion of slavery, while the Democrats are open to the possibility of it.
Right. The Democrats taking, of course, that squatter sovereignty or popular sovereignty approach. Yeah, notice that within the regions, you still have a choice. You see, a vital and vibrant two-party system, in part, is built on the idea of giving people real choices. Right? And so within the section, you've still got a choice there, right? Within the North, you've still got the Whigs taking a different position from the Democrats. And, for that matter, in the South, right? The Whigs are taking a different position from the Democrats. Now, I think the writing's on the wall that this is not a good thing in the long run for a well-integrated national two-party system. But you can see the parties trying to sort of come to terms with this, trying to deal with this very difficult issue. Okay, well, let's move ahead. So note that within the sections, the parties are still able to take different positions regarding the compromise issue, but clearly unified national parties are in serious trouble here. A sectional realignment appears to have begun. All right. But arguably the single most important element that comes out of the compromise of 1850 is this tough new federal fugitive slave law. In the North, Whigs denounced the compromise as a Democratic document, especially obnoxious because of this controversial fugitive slave law. What exactly did this mean? It made it illegal, it made it a federal offense to help escape slaves, to help fugitive slaves, or a federal offense to refuse to cooperate with federal officials who were responsible for tracking them down and returning them to their masters. This would produce a storm of controversy in the North. A lot of opposition in the North, where most people were outraged by this feature of the compromise. And we should emphasize this point. Remember, of course, as we said a couple lectures ago, we were talking about the abolitionist movement. Of course, most Northerners are not abolitionists, but they don't like this idea of the federal government intervening in state affairs in this way. They don't like local officials having to go along with federal slave catchers. So many people who are not, by any means, many Northerners who are not by any means abolitionists are concerned about this. And you could say in some respects, the Compromise of 1850 did what abolitionists had failed to do thus far. That is, it really alarmed Northerners regarding the slavery issue. Okay, and there's a lot of fallout from that, as we'll see. You can see here's a broadside from Boston warning Boston's a significant free black population that they needed to be concerned, they needed to be worried and careful about being kidnapped. All right, for several reasons, then, the compromise would prove to be very unhealthy for the second party system. Now, there were those who favored the compromise as the definitive resolution of the seemingly endless slavery extension debate. Remember, I noted already how now, once vice president, now President Fillmore, wanted to enforce loyalty to the compromise within the Whig Party, to use it as a kind of litmus test. Just as Northern Democrats wanted support for the compromise also to be a test of party loyalty. But this had all sorts of bad consequences. If this agreement was enforced, so let's enforce the support for the Compromise of 1850 as a kind of sign of party loyalty. If that happened, the two major parties then would not disagree on this issue. Remember, we said that one of the key features of a vital and vibrant two-party system is to really have different positions, distinctive positions on issues. Especially issues that Americans, that most Americans cared a lot about. Well, if the agreement was enforced in this way, the two major parties would have consensus over this issue. Some politicians thought that was okay. They viewed the slavery extension issue or the slavery question in general as too difficult, as too controversial, as a political hot potato that they simply couldn't handle. And they thought that new issues, perhaps maybe even new parties, would emerge once the compromise had been universally accepted. Well, as we'll see, the issues don't go away. New parties do emerge. The question remains, what if the two major parties did agree about the finality of the compromise, but voters in the North and the South remained unhappy about its features and remained concerned about the larger issue of slavery's extension? What then would happen to the once loyal constituencies of the major parties? Might they grow disenchanted with the major parties, go looking elsewhere for political groups that were addressing these concerns, you know, these concerns about slavery in a meaningful way? Well, this, of course, is precisely what happened in the North in the wake of the compromise. In other words, at just the point when many Northerners are starting to say, wait a minute, this is a serious issue. This does have serious political consequences. Okay, I don't necessarily support black equality or immediate emancipation, but I'm worried about the political power of slave owners, especially in the national government. And I'm worried about the expansion of the slave system. Remember, we talked about that free soil ideology last time that many Northerners subscribed to. All right, so voters appear to have grown steadily more disenchanted with the traditional parties, and they began to gravitate to the call of third parties. In the North, there was a Free Soil Party that had run back in 1848. It was gathering some momentum and was attracting the support of some individuals, former Democrats like David Wilmot of Pennsylvania and others. Of course, we saw earlier that the parties had been able sometimes to handle the slavery extension issue, but now a nationally enforced agreement on that question denied them the issue at about the same time that both Northerners and Southerners were increasingly fearing threats to the survival of the Republic arising from that very question. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about what happens between 1850, the passage of the compromise, 1850, and of course we have in the presidential election cycle 1852 coming up. And how are the two major political parties going to handle that? How are they going to handle 1852? So that's the situation as the presidential contest approaches of 1852. Both major parties were in serious trouble in most states, with the Whigs disintegrating especially rapidly in the Deep South. In the South, you see, especially in some states of the Deep South, you see the traditional parties falling apart. You see the emergence of a kind of a states' rights party, of a kind of southern rights party emerging. It takes on different names in different states in the Deep South. And then in some cases, a unionist party, sometimes made up of former Whigs. But definitely the second party system is in serious shape in many southern states by 1851, 1852. So you could say that the presidential contest of 1852 was only another nail in the coffin of the second-party system. The Whigs were in a particularly tight spot as a result of erosion of support for the party at the national level. Here, a critical factor was immigration. This is something we haven't talked too much about for a while, but it's something that has serious political consequences for the Whigs, and especially for how they handle the question of immigrant voting, immigrant support. The immigrant population, especially Roman Catholic immigrants, had grown by leaps and bounds during the 1840s, and most of them were courted by the Democratic Party. First of all, we should pause and note just how large a group we're talking about here. People talk a lot about illegal immigration today, but look at these numbers. It's really quite remarkable. 3 million foreigners came to the U.S. between 1846 and 1854. 3 million. Now, how does that compare in terms of total population? That constitutes 14.5% of the 1845 population. So those are huge numbers. Obviously, that's going to be viewed, especially by native-born evangelical Protestants, with some alarm. They're going to be alarmed by this influx of Catholics, and as we shall see, they're going to organize politically to meet this perceived threat. In a couple of minutes, I'm going to talk about how they organize politically, first in these secret fraternal organizations, ultimately in a national political party called the American Party. Let's set that aside just for a minute here. Stay focused on the 1852 election. Traditionally, of course, it was the Whigs who had appealed to native-born Americans, especially evangelical Protestants, at least in the North. And it was the Whigs who had opposed unrestricted immigration and short naturalization periods for citizenship. You know, in some states, the naturalization period was very short, 5 years. Actually, it's interesting, in some states, recent immigrants could vote without becoming citizens. So laws varied. The Whig dilemma in 1852 could be described or expressed this way. Are you going to continue, if you're, you know, asking the question here of a Whig party leader, is your political party going to continue to just kiss goodbye to all of those new voters? Or are you going to try to somehow integrate them to somehow attract their support? So here's the dilemma. retain your traditional supporters, but continue to turn away the growing body of new Americans, or, of course, here's the danger, alienate your old supporters and make a play for these immigrant groups. You know, otherwise they would simply just continue to flock, to flood the ranks of the Democratic Party. In retrospect, we can see that the Whigs did the wrong thing, at least in terms of survival. They opted for changing their approach. They opted to make a play for this new immigrant vote. Remember, we talked about this a couple, a few lectures ago. We talked about what we called negative reference group voting. And we talked about the cultural factors, cultural and religious factors that help us understand why people voted the way they did in the 19th century, especially in the second party system. And you can imagine how the traditional constituency of the Whig Party, especially in the North, is going to be at the very least confused and at the worst really antagonized by this a new approach. So the Whigs opt for a risky strategy to go after the immigrants. In 1852, they nominate General Winfield Scott, predictably another war hero, another Mexican war hero, to be their standard bearer. In the campaign, they downplayed traditional issues. They downplayed their traditional opposition to unrestricted immigration. They downplayed some of their traditional issues like temperance, prohibition laws that they had long been champions of. And they tried to portray the Democratic nominee, Franklin Pierce, as anti-Catholic, which was quite a stretch. There's Scott on the left and Franklin Pierce on the right. Pierce was a brigadier general from the War of Mexico and a party politician. And Scott, as I said, one of the, most important general in that war. And so they try to portray Pierce as anti-Catholic. This proves to be a huge miscalculation, as people are not suddenly convinced that the Whig Party, immigrants are certainly not suddenly convinced that the Whig Party is now their friend. So immigrants continue to support the Democratic Party, and the Whigs thereby removed the last major source of difference. Remember, we said difference is important in a healthy two-party system. They removed the last major source of difference between themselves and their Democratic opponents. The Democrats, as I said, had nominated Franklin Pierce, senator from New Hampshire, more recently a brigadier general during the war with Mexico. The campaign was especially dirty, even by 19th century standards, and personal. A lot of attack, what we would describe today as attack ads against the two candidates. The Whigs had a lot of nasty things to say about Franklin Pierce, said that he had personal problems, including alcoholism. They said that he was in the, because of his time in the Mexican War, he was the victor of many a hard-fought battle. I thought it was a clever saying, you know. You can imagine with the slavery issue taken out of the picture, the two parties are really kind of grasping at straws, trying to figure out how to appeal to the electorate, and especially now if the Whigs are trying to portray themselves as suddenly, you know, pro-immigration. There seem to be few real issues separating the major parties, and this appears to have undermined popular confidence in them. At the same time, some believe that the economic prosperity of the 1850s may also have played into the picture. At the time, the Baltimore Sun commented, quote, "Unexampled prosperity renders it difficult to create excitement about party politics," end quote. So there's some indication that people were simply interested in economic prosperity and not that interested in voting. Voting analysis for 1852 suggests that the decline in support for the Whigs did not translate into support for the Democrats. Rather, abstentions, that is, eligible voters who just decide to stay home, those climbed markedly from the previous presidential election. Again, further evidence of a lack of public confidence in the second party system. right? If the traditional parties aren't meeting your needs, aren't addressing your concerns, you're going to either stay home or look elsewhere. Maybe you'll do both. So the Whigs end up losing badly, predictably, in 1852 to Franklin Pierce and the Democratic Party. Most significant, however, was the fact that the two major parties were almost completely silent on the political issues that most interested Americans during the middle 1850s. Two of them we've already talked about a fair bit, right? Talked about the slavery expansion, slavery extension issue, number one. And number two, we talked a little bit about immigration. So on both those questions, the parties are virtually silent in 1852. That alienates a lot of voters. Oh, a third issue, which often doesn't get much attention, was probably more important on the state level, but still was an issue, is the question of temperance. Temperance laws, or what was sometimes called the Maine Law, which was a prohibition law first passed in Maine back in the 1840s. That also was an issue. Of course, it was an issue, again, that traditionally the Whigs had championed, especially in the North. But for all of those issues were not mentioned, were hardly mentioned at all during the 1852 campaign. Okay, I want to go back to the question of immigration for a moment here and see how the public alienation from the two parties gives fruit to the development of a new party, which some people think might have been the replacement. We know ultimately, of course, in retrospect now, with the gift of hindsight, we know it wasn't. But at the time, some people thought it might be the replacement for the declining Whig Party. And this is the Know-Nothing or American Party. Okay, so what's happening? In the 1850s, we witness a period of political realignment. The Whig Party is dying. The Democratic Party, by the way, is changing. It survives, but it doesn't survive unchanged. And new minor parties vie for the support of Americans who are disenchanted with the present political situation. For many Americans, something had gone terribly wrong. So the minor parties that emerge in the 1850s are addressing the question, you know, what's gone wrong? What's the most serious threat to the republic and to self-government? What's the most serious threat? What is it? Is it slavery's expansion? Is that it? A lot of Northerners would have said yes. Some Southerners would have said yes in terms of, you know, defending their right to expand and take their personal property anywhere. Some would say immigration. Now, I want to turn, as I said, and look at that group, for voters, the people who are most concerned about immigration as the primary issue. All right, well, as we said, the influx of Roman Catholic immigrants had helped spawn groups of anti-Catholic nativists. They were organized first into secret fraternal organizations, so-called Know-Nothing Lodges. You know how they're given that name, right? They're secret fraternal organizations, so when you're asked to talk about this group that you belong to, you're supposed to say, well, I know nothing, right? And so the name sort of stuck. Nativists came from lower middle class backgrounds, and they feared both the political and economic consequences of the arrival of thousands, especially thousands of immigrants, especially Catholics. Through the Democratic Party, nativists believe that the Catholics could secretly control the government. And they talked about Catholics being loyal to a foreign power, to a foreign potentate in the form of the Pope. Plus, thousands of immigrants would also, argue the nativists, lower wages for workers in the cities and push native-born Americans into what one nativist newspaper editor called pushing us into the Western wilds. So the political side of the issue here was probably the strongest for the nativists. That is, they were convinced that Catholics had an inordinate influence within the national government, especially through their agent, the Democratic Party. You know, in the same way that free soil people in the North were concerned that Southerners had an inordinate influence in the national government through the agency of the Democratic Party. Right? So similar kinds of language was used to describe the situation, to describe this threat to Republican government. So like the earlier Free Soilers, and like the later Republicans, and we'll talk about the origins of the Republican Party next time, the Know-Nothings used traditional Republican, small r, Republican political rhetoric to portray Catholics as a threat to Republican government. It was the Catholic Church now, rather than the slave power, that was undermining true Republican principles. As you can see in our cartoon here, you've got, you've got the two different immigrant groups here illustrated. What are they doing? They're stealing the ballot box, right? Who's this? Germans drinking their lager beer. I don't know how you guys would know that, but I'll just move on quickly. And we have, of course, the Irish with their whiskey, who are also always involved in rioting. And so you got them stealing the ballot box. So again, it was, you know, how are these immigrant groups undermining the traditional political order, Republican political order in America? Catholicism, said the nativists, was a despotic faith. After all, it was organized hierarchically. It wasn't democratic, you know, like say, the Congregationalist Church was in New England. It was organized hierarchically. You had to obey the people above you. And Catholics supposedly wanted to control public education. And wasn't public education the bulwark of the Republican system? And not just the bulwark of the Republican system, but also a way in which the evangelical Protestant faith was passed on. This may seem strike us as odd today, but remember, public schools in those days are often run by religious societies, and there's Bible reading in the schools and so on. So, nativists are concerned about Catholics infiltrating the Democratic Party. The Democrats were viewed as the toadies of the Catholics. Meanwhile, the Know-Nothings saw themselves as a kind of people's party, opposed to the corrupt traditional parties that had been perverted by the Catholic interest, as they called it. The formal name of the party was the American Party, and they were very successful, especially at the state level, in the mid-1850s, 1853, 54, 55. They were quite successful. In states like Massachusetts. The Know-Nothings won several key state elections because there was a general feeling among the voters that they wanted to throw off the old party organizations. In other words, in some respects, the American Party was a kind of no-party or anti-party party, right? In that it was really saying, hey, we're different from the other two conventional traditional parties. They wanted to destroy, they said, the power of hack politicians and party wire pullers and bagmen. They pushed for party nominees being named by votes in local lodges rather than, you know, in huge national nominating conventions that could be manipulated by, you know, the proverbial men in smoke-filled rooms. And there's some indication, as political historians have analyzed the sort of people who supported and participated in the American Party, there's some indication that, yes, indeed, these American Party, these Know-Nothing folk, were different. They came from a lower socioeconomic strata. They tended to be younger. That's interesting. Most of the candidates were under 35 years old. Less wealthy, less affluent than their opponents in the traditional parties. And they often held more modest occupations, such as clerks or artisans. Now, prior to the rise of the Republican Party in the Midwest, and as I said, we'll be focusing mostly on that next time, prior to the rise of the Republicans, you could be excused for thinking in, say, 1853, 54, that this is going to be the new major party, that is, the American Party, is going to really be the replacement for the Whig Party. Until the Republican Party emerges and shows significant northern support, it's unclear whether or not the know-nothings might actually end up being, go on to become the major political opposition to the Democratic Party. There was some support for the American Party in the South, and there was a support at the top of national politics, too. We'll see how Millard Fillmore later runs for the American Party. There's certainly some support for nativism among Whigs, given their traditional position regarding immigration and immigrants. That's not too surprising. All right. I'm going to move on here. Now, all of that is background to what then happens in 1854 with another congressional compromise. And this time, we're also talking about the issue that keeps coming up, the issue of the expansion of slavery into the territories. Here, however, we're talking about the introduction of legislation to organize a portion of that vast swath of territory that had been purchased from France by President Jefferson, the Louisiana Purchase. A large portion of that territory had never really been organized. And Congress turns to address that issue in 1854. Historians have long scratched their heads about, well, why did they turn to it then? Couldn't northern politicians in particular see how dangerous an issue the slavery extension issue was, and that maybe it would be good to have a little bit of a respite from the debate? But for a variety of reasons, Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois, the little giant, there he is in our two portraits there, introduces legislation which comes to be called the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And what's he up to? Well, in part, he wants to organize at least some of that portion, the northern portion, or central and northern portion of the Louisiana Purchase territory. He wants to organize that. Why is he so interested in organizing it? Variety of explanations here, and I think one shouldn't necessarily zero in on just one. Douglas was a devoted unionist, and he'd been a champion of Western development for some time in his hopes to provide a kind of balance between the North-South conflict that had characterized politics for decades. So definitely Douglas is a committed unionist. Of course, his unionism, his commitment to the Union, dovetails rather nicely and neatly with his own particular political ambitions. He's very interested in getting the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And he recognizes that as a Northern Democrat, he needs Southern support. But of course, it's a tricky balancing act, right? How can I be a successful national politician given the sectional realignment that's occurring in American politics in the mid-1850s? How do I do that? How do I pull that off? How do I pull off that magic trick? Douglas, it seems, hoped the Democrats could use this, that is, use this issue of, organizing this territory, Democrats could use this as a party issue, championing the old Democratic Party war horse, popular sovereignty in the territories. So Douglas and others sought to facilitate the building of a transcontinental railroad line. And Douglas from the state of Illinois says, I'd kind of like that line to be through Illinois. It would certainly benefit my state. And the best way to do that, one of the ways to ensure that is to make sure that there would be a northern route, would be to organize some of that territory. Certainly, that northerly transcontinental line would greatly benefit his state and his section. And Douglas thought, proved to be, I think, a serious miscalculation in the long run, Douglas thought, I can do this with some Southern support if we open up, at least technically, potentially, if we open up some of that territory, that organized, previously unorganized territory, to the possible expansion of slavery. But of course, Douglas, being a good Democrat, wants to allow popular sovereignty to determine the status of slavery in those territories. Now, I'm going to leave you today with a question. In order to do that, in order to organize that territory, in order to ensure that popular sovereignty determines the status of slavery in those two territories, there they are, Kansas and Nebraska, unfortunately, you have to repeal the Missouri Compromise. Because remember, the Missouri Compromise stipulated that slavery would not expand into any new territory north of the latitude 3630. And that is opening up a huge can of worms. And we'll turn and look at the consequences of that are very serious indeed next time. Thank you.